Hello and welcome to the first hour of the Arizona Republic for Wednesday, January 14th, 2026. This is Carrie, your volunteer reader with Sun Sounds of Arizona. We'll begin this first hour with two front-page articles from the Republic, the first on Governor Hobbs and the second on the Arizona Rangers. Then we'll move to articles from Valley and State section of the paper and conclude the first hour with national and world news with articles from USA Today. Our first article is on Governor Hobbs in the State of the State, a speech section of the paper. It's entitled, Hobbs Focuses on an Affordable Arizona. The subtitle is, Governor Delivers Fourth State of the Speech Address. This is by Stacey Barchanger. Governor Katie Hobbs put her focus squarely on making life more affordable for Arizonans feeling the pinch of higher costs in the final State of the State speech of her first term as governor. Hobbs' 45-minute speech was given to Arizona lawmakers and their guests at the State House of Representatives on January 12th, but its message appeared targeted to Arizona voters stressed by rising costs. Hobbs, a Democrat seeking re-election this November, repeatedly turned back to efforts to make life more affordable, and the governor portrayed that as one area to find common ground with the Republican majority at the Capitol. Hobbs spoke about the issue in personal terms, noting that she worked at Pizza Hut to put herself through college and took extra jobs to support her family when she was a lawmaker. She bragged about ways her administration has sought to lower costs already, including erasing medical debt for nearly 500,000 Arizonans and lowering the cost of child care through last year's budget. Affordability isn't a joke or some hoax, Hobbs said. It's a real and consequential challenge that families across Arizona must grapple with every day. Pocketbooks are strained, and Arizonans need their elected officials to take action. Hobbs called on lawmakers to immediately pass her version of a plan to replicate part of President Donald Trump's massive tax package signed into law in July. But Hobbs' version picks and chooses certain policies and leaves out tax breaks for corporations, making it a non-starter with Republicans who want to comply more closely with the president's plan. The GOP-backed plan is expected to get a first vetting at the Capitol on January 14th. The speech was light on new policy announcements, but Hobbs did reiterate her goals to create new fees on short-term rentals and data centers in order to fund aid for families to pay their utility bills and water conservation, respectively. Hobbs also called for ending a tax exemption for data centers and said she would make a $20 million investment into a new Arizona Affordability Fund to help lower utility costs and create affordable housing. Those new fees fell flat with Republicans. Governor Hobbs says her focus is affordability, but her actions tell a different story, said Senate President pro tempore T.J. Shope, Republican of Coolidge. Instead of lowering costs, she's proposing new fees and new taxes on short-term rentals and data centers, costs that get passed directly onto families. Hobbs did announce that the Arizona Department of Water Resources had created a groundwater management area in La Paz County, a process that had been underway and is the second administratively created regulation area in the state. Hobbs talked vaguely about plans to reduce the state's expenditures by $100 million over the next 3 years, which she dubbed the Arizona Capacity and Efficiency Initiative. She also spoke in support of funding K-12 public education and foreshadowed changes she will propose to the state's private school voucher program called Empowerment Scholarship Accounts. In my plan, the original mission of the ESA program to help kids with disabilities and in military families remains untouched, Hobbs said. But even the program's most ardent supporters must agree. It's time we tackle the waste, fraud, and abuse to ensure taxpayer dollars are going towards true educational purposes. More details of both proposals are expected to be released on January 16th, when Hobbs debuts her budget plan. Senator Mitzi Epstein, Democrat of Tempe, acknowledged Hobbs could have given a few more details in her speech, including about the effort to save the state $100 million. Epstein was one of several lawmakers interviewed who didn't know what Hobbs meant. "When you find out, let me know," she said. Marisol Garcia, president of the Arizona Education Association Teachers Union, welcomed Hobbs' renewed attention on vouchers and her calls to extend Proposition 123, an expired funding measure that draws state land trust dollars to support K-12 education. Garcia said speaking in high-level terms could have a benefit in later negotiations. "The reality with this legislature and the governor is that when you talk too specifically, we are left in our corners unable to have deep conversation," she said. "I'm an eighth grade teacher. My goal is to get kids out of corners so that we can sit down and get to a better place, because we have to work with each other." And for many Republicans, the details won't make a difference. Senator President Warren Peterson, Republican of Gilbert, made that clear during his own comments before Hobbs took the dais to deliver her speech. "For those who have come down here to try to eliminate school choice, that is not going to happen," he said. "Parents know their children best, and they deserve as many educational options as possible." In targeting waste, fraud, and abuse, Hobbs borrowed a piece of political rhetoric often used by the Trump administration. She repeatedly portrayed Arizona's government as efficient and effective when compared to the leadership in Washington, D.C. "We delivered 10 million school meals to children who needed them, while Washington cut food assistance and then held it hostage during the federal government shutdown," Hobbs said of her work in 2025. "And the budget we passed was bipartisan and balanced. While the Washington budget was partisan and skyrocketed the national debt by trillions of dollars, leaving our children and grandchildren to pick up the tab for our federal government's reckless and irresponsible spending." She also blasted the federal government for rejecting an emergency declaration after flooding swept through Globe and parts of Gila County last year. Hobbs used the issue as one of several throughout her speech to call for bipartisanship. "I hope elected officials on both sides of this chamber and in Congress join me in calling on the Federal Emergency Management Agency to right this wrong and reverse their callous decision to deny our communities emergency assistance," Hobbs said. "To the people of Globe and Miami, you deserve better than this. We will continue to fight for you and all Arizonans, especially when Washington, D.C. won't." While many of Hobbs' goals prompted standing ovations from Democratic lawmakers in the chamber, the speech was received coolly by Republicans. Still, it was notable that the lengthy address did not prompt antics, as in prior years, when GOP lawmakers turned their backs on the governor or left the chamber entirely. Hobbs did not discuss issues that have animated Democrats in past elections, such as LGBTQ rights or abortion access, save for passing references to allowing Arizonans the freedom to decide who to love and to make your own medical decisions, including how and when to grow your family. "She sounded more like a Republican," said Representative Matt Gress, Republican of Phoenix and a former staffer for GOP Governor Doug Ducey. Gress pointed to Hobbs' calls for $100 million in spending reductions and her nod to her request to the Trump administration to pay Arizona over $760 million for border costs. Hobbs also mentioned her past deployment of the Arizona National Guard to the border and task forces that she said helped seize more than 16,000 pounds of fentanyl, 1,200 firearms, and made over 1,400 arrests. While the federal government uses law enforcement resources to score political points in cities thousands of miles from the southern border, Arizona is laser-focused on securing the border, getting drugs off the streets, and cracking down on criminals poisoning our neighborhoods and our children, she said. Some Republicans gave Hobbs a bit of credit for reaching toward the middle on some issues. Her hope for reconciliation of Colorado River water cuts in a way that favored Arizona was a place where I think we can come together, Shope said. In general, and voucher reform aside, her speech was lesser on the wish list of things that are completely impossible, he said. And that article is entitled, Hobbs Focuses on an Affordable Arizona, and that was by Stacey Bartschanger. Our next front page article from the Republic today is entitled, Legislation Targets Arizona Rangers. The subtitle is, Legendary Group Could Be Stripped of Legal Status. This is by Ray Stern. The Arizona Rangers are experiencing one of their worst scandals the police assistance group has had in a century. State documents now in the hands of a state senator accuse the group's state commander, Barry Adams, of blowing the cover of undercover officers to a motorcycle gang. They reveal how its deputy state commander was kicked out of a police academy in 2021, and its third top official had his peace officer certification revoked following a probe over tens of thousands in loans he failed to repay. The revelations first emerged in a series of blog posts published since July and have now led to new legislation that threatens to strip the Arizona Rangers of their legal status in state statutes. The group, whose history dates back to territorial days, has hundreds of members in at least 24 companies across the state. Its members aren't sworn officers and can't make arrests, but they're empowered by state laws that give them an edge that similar nonprofit organizations, like the Maricopa County Sheriff's Office Volunteer Posse, don't possess. Many of the members have backgrounds in police agencies or the military. They typically wear uniforms with badges, plus sidearms and bullet-resistant vests that make them almost indistinguishable from typical law enforcement officers. They're attached to numerous law enforcement agencies in the state by government agreements, and in 2021 prominently served as security for the state Senate's audit of the 2020 election, raising at least $175,000 in donations. Brian Keenan, a freelance journalist, has been publishing his criticisms about the group's leader since February 2025, after he applied to be a ranger and was rejected over a past DUI. Other rangers started reaching out to me, giving me information, providing all the juicy details on the rangers that I didn't even know about, Keenan said. And the reason why is because I broke the silence on the rangers. After learning about the leaders in documents first published in Keenan's blog, Code 3 News, State Senator Mark Fincham, a Prescott Republican, sponsored a bill for the upcoming 2026 legislative session to repeal the Arizona Rangers from state laws. He met with Arizona Rangers leadership in November before deciding to craft the bill, which is co-sponsored by Flagstaff Republican Senator Wendy Rogers. We have looked at everything with a critical eye, Fincham told the Arizona Republic. As more questions about the group emerge, one of its leaders told the Republic many of the rangers may have shady incidents in their backgrounds. What would Senator Mark Fincham's bill do? Senate Bill 1071 would repeal a law signed by former Governor Jane Hull in 2002 that gives the group its modern powers. The law currently describes the Arizona Rangers as an unpaid, non-commissioned civilian auxiliary that is available for the purpose of assisting and supporting law enforcement in this state. While the law states they don't have any police or investigative powers beyond what the average citizen has, it also says they can provide law enforcement support and assistance services under the control and supervision of established law enforcement officials if requested. The group would still be a nonprofit private organization, but Fincham's bill would restrain its ability to attach its members to law enforcement. The bill would repeal another law exempting the Arizona Rangers from needing to obtain licenses as security guards, which would affect the group's ability to provide security services outside of any contracts it has with law enforcement agencies. Finally, the bill would repeal a 1955 law that allows Arizona Rangers to obtain state pensions. However, that law appears to have applied only to the original Arizona Rangers, a handful of whom were still alive in 1995. Yavapai County Sheriff David Rhodes told the Republic he and several senators were among those who had concerns about the group in its current form. "I think we need to make it clear through this legislation that they're not law enforcement officers," Rhodes said. The nonprofit organization's website states recruits need to be at least 21 years old, hold a state concealed carry weapon permit, and successfully graduate from its Arizona Ranger Training Academy, according to its website. The group also requires background checks for members. Yet the group has no responsibility or mandate to share information about its members to any law enforcement group. "There's no accountability or transparency around that organization," Rhodes said, calling the Rangers a quasi-law enforcement group that is very confusing to the public. Rhodes said frustration with the Arizona Rangers had been growing for more than a year, in part because of the group's lack of transparency. In 2024, he met with state leaders of the group who promised they would provide training records and background check information about their membership, but never did. "The public has a right to know who these people are," he said, adding he talked to Fincham about his concerns. Group dates to 1901, engages in police assistance. The Arizona Rangers, patterned after the Texas Rangers, originated with a territorial law authorizing them in 1901 to act as a state police force with 26 members. The original organization was disbanded in 1909, returned in some form from the 1920s into the 1940s, and were restructured in 1957 as an auxiliary force similar to the modern group. The 2002 law spurred partnerships with the Arizona Rangers that continue to be popular. Municipal police agencies in small towns and large cities like Chandler and Scottsdale, and sheriff's offices around the state have partnered with the group. The Globe Police Department, for example, signed a contract with the group in October to provide various services following assistance the group provided during the September floods in the area. The Globe contract allows members of the Arizona Rangers to provide crime scene security, acting as a secondary officer, second man in the car, critical incident response, foot patrols of designated areas, and traffic control operations, both in coordination with and independent of agency officials when appropriate. Like many agencies, Globe Police trusts that Arizona Rangers members are properly certified and vetted by the group. "We rely on them to do their own backgrounds and vetting of their personnel," said Globe Police Commander Charles Haynes. "We don't run a background on them ourselves or require them to provide backgrounds on every single person that they're going to send to us." Haynes and other members of other agencies praise the group's ability to assist law enforcement. "They have been a godsend for us because we're a smaller agency," said Lieutenant Michael Falquez of the Sahuarita Police Department in southern Arizona. The Arizona Rangers assist the town's police force, which has 70 officers. Falquez said Rangers help with traffic control during vehicle collisions, security at major crime scenes, including homicides and large events. "The department has donated a few patrol cars to the group," he said, adding that Arizona Rangers aren't allowed to conduct traffic stops or engage in investigations. Arizona Rangers commander denies gang affiliation. One of the most explosive documents about the Rangers from the state's Peace Officer Standards and Training Board is a 2006 warning to law enforcement agencies about Adams, the group's state commander. He had worked as a deputy for the Yuma County Sheriff's Office from 1994 to 2003. 3 years later, after he resigned from the office, his former colleague, then Lieutenant Darren Simmons, sent an email to the Arizona Post stating Adams was a known associate of the Hells Angels Tucson chapter who had identified undercover officers at an event and identified them to the Hells Angels members, which was an extreme officer safety issue. The Post report, which was among several documents about the Arizona Rangers that Fincham shared with the Republic, stated, "This case was open for information purposes and should be reviewed in the event Mr. Barry makes application for certification." Simmons, who retired from the sheriff's office and is now one of five Yuma County supervisors, said the event was a fundraiser for a puppet group of the Hells Angels held at a Yuma bar, Crazy Earl's. Simmons wasn't there, but he said he obtained the information from a gang intelligence sergeant he trusted. "At the time, there was no reason for me to doubt the report," Simmons said. No investigation came of the bulletin. Adams strongly denied that he ever associated with Hells Angels members or gave them confidential information. Hernal Aitken, the Arizona Rangers state secretary, who said Adams is his friend, told the Republic he once asked former Yuma County Sheriff Ralph Ogden, who died in 2017, about the allegation, and Ogden told him it had been debunked, but there's no record of that. Adams never formally challenged the Post information. "I was told I could only challenge it if seeking employment with a law enforcement agency," he said. "I haven't heard the lie since 2015, so it really wasn't something I felt I needed to worry about." Adams told the Republic that when he applied to be a Border Patrol agent in 2007, they looked at it twice and cleared me. He later applied to the Tucson Police Department and passed a polygraph test about the accusation, he said. He didn't continue his application with the Tucson Police because he received an offer to work for the Border Patrol at the same time, he said. "I've been asked if I want to sue people numerous times over it," Adams said, "and the reality is I want to be left alone." Adams added he hasn't yet made a decision about whether he should step down from his leadership position. Rangers leaders downplay reports about their past. Keenan's blog posts and the documents obtained by Fincham include accusations that top Arizona Rangers officials, including Adams, Deputy State Commander Lisa Penny, and others, embellished their credentials in various emails, forums, and publications. For instance, Adams told fellow Rangers in emails he had served a short term as a federal agent, claimed in another email he had started the first canine unit at the Yuma County Sheriff's Office, and led a SWAT team at the border after the terrorist attacks on September 11, 2001. Tim Smith, an Arizona Rangers internal affairs officer, dismissed the claims after an inquiry, another document shows. The inquiry found that although Adams resigned from the Border Patrol while still a trainee due to an injury, he still did serve, albeit not as a fully sworn agent. Smith wrote that he talked to Adams, who confirmed he did lead a SWAT team on 9/11. Adams sent the Republic a 2012 email from current Yuma County Sheriff Leon Wilmot, who held the rank of a major then, stating how a history of the office was being compiled and that he did not have all the info on the first canine, which was yours. However, Keenan published a letter in one of his blog posts by a sheriff's office paralegal following an April 2025 request for records that per current employees who worked with him, Adams was never a SWAT commander and he was not the founder and commander of the K-9 unit. Neither Wilmot nor a sheriff's office spokesperson returned emails or calls from the Republic about the matter. In a July 2025 email, Adams noted that Smith had cleared him and determined there had been no evidence of policy violations by three other leaders. Penny, when interviewed by the Republic by phone, painted herself as a victim of mistakes or malfeasance by other people. She sought a position with the Tombstone Marshal's Office in 2021, which required her to attend the Southeast Arizona Law Enforcement Training Academy and acknowledged the academy dismissed her. But she denied the academy's claim that she was dismissed for violations of academy policy, conduct, and rules, insubordination, professional conduct, honesty, and unprofessionalism, as an AZ Post document states. "I do not agree with it," she said of the alleged violations, adding she fought it for a year before the Post cleared her. The Post closed her case in April 2022, but Fincham's documents didn't include all of the paperwork that went with the case. The Republic submitted a records request with the Post for the rest of the documents in the case that has not yet been fulfilled. Penny served as a corrections officer for the Benton County Sheriff's Office in Washington from January 1989 to September 1994, the county's payroll office told the Republic. She's also worked as a nurse, but has drawn criticism in Keenan's articles for overstating her law enforcement credentials. In one example, Keenan highlighted a September 2021 article about her in the Arizona Rangers magazine, states she had a career in law enforcement. Penny told the Republic she never said that, but might have mentioned she had been in the law enforcement world. Hernal Aitken, who holds the position of secretary in the Arizona Rangers, quit his job as an officer for the Yuma Police Department in December 2008 over loans he had failed to repay, Post documents show. The Post revoked his certification to work as a law enforcement officer in 2011, accusing him of receiving over $130,000 in loans from six Yuma business people and failing to repay them and lying to an investigator about not paying for a two-month stay in a motel. Aitken, in a phone interview, put some of the blame on what he described as his demanding ex-wife, who insisted their children go to a private school and make him pay for other expenses. He meant to pay back the nice people who had deep pockets from whom he borrowed money, but his lawyer ultimately advised him not to after declaring bankruptcy, he said. Really and truly, Aitken said, if you were to pose and ask every ranger in this organization to give you their background, I'm probably going to tell you that I think a good 25% of them would refuse to because they've got shady things in their background. And that article was entitled Legislation Targets Arizona Rangers, and that was by Ray Stern. Moving on to Valiant State News, this article is entitled Sedona Makes List for Wealthy Lifestyle at a Middle Class Costs. This is by Rhea Lee. An Arizona town where even doctors can't afford to buy a home was named one of the most affordable cities for middle class people looking for a luxurious lifestyle in a new ranking. Personal finance website Go Banking Rates names Sedona as one of 10 small towns in the United States where middle-class budgets unlock lifestyles once reserved for the wealthy. Many household expenses in Sedona are more affordable than in Metro Phoenix area. For example, gas prices in Yavapai County, where Sedona is located, are consistently lower than in Maricopa County. And Sedona certainly offers a spread of luxury experiences, as the study notes, from spas to high-end restaurants. However, the elephant in the room is Sedona's housing prices. A typical one-bedroom Sedona apartment rents for $1,800, according to apartment research firm Zumper Incorporated. The average home value is $880,391, according to Zillow. In Phoenix, for comparison, that value is $403,317. Investors buying up homes to turn into short-term rentals has driven a housing shortage in Sedona. As many as 20% of Sedona's homes are short-term vacation rentals, the Arizona Republic reported in 2025. Sedona hosts annual film and arts festivals, making the luxury and creative community truly accessible, the study stated. Accessible, perhaps, for out-of-town visitors, but not for people looking to make Sedona their home. And that article was entitled, Sedona Makes List for Wealthy Lifestyle at a Middle Class Costs, and that was by Rhea Lee. We're approximately 29 minutes past the hour in this first hour of the Arizona Republic for Wednesday, January 14th, 2026. Continuing with Valiant State News, this next article is entitled, How Cancer is Upending Lives of Arizona Firefighters. This is by Laura Gersoni. Ashley Leatham knew there were risks when her late husband, Scott, built his career as a firefighter. He ran into burning buildings, rode ambulances through intersections against traffic, and accompanied police on SWAT operations as a paramedic in situations that could quickly turn tense and dangerous. What she never imagined was cancer. Married for 18 years, the couple lived simply, saving as Scott worked his way up from a $10.40 an hour EMT to captain in the Tempe Fire Department. They raised two children and eventually settled in a quiet Gilbert suburb. "We had a good life," she said in an interview with the Arizona Republic. That life unraveled in months. In July 2024, Scott Lethem was diagnosed with nut carcinoma, a rare cancer that spread through his nose and right eye. The illness was classified as line of duty related, having been contracted on the job. He died that December at the age of 39. Lethem is one of 14 firefighters honored January 11th at the Arizona State Capitol during an annual ceremony recognizing fire service members who died in the line of duty. Their names will be added to the memorial monument at Wesley Bolin Plaza. The annual ceremony allows fire service members to come together and mourn those they have lost, according to Dan Freiberg, president of the Professional Firefighters of Arizona. Of the 14 firefighters being honored Sunday, five died from cancer. The others died while responding to wildfires across the state or while driving or riding in ambulances. "It's really a hallowed ground for us," he said. "It's a day to be there for each other and families of the fallen." The issue is also a sensitive policy matter. Arizona's laws governing firefighters' occupational cancer, the leading cause of death in the profession, are a recurring source of debate at the legislature, particularly between worker advocates and insurance companies that shoulder the costs of line-of-duty deaths. "We really wish that there was no such thing as firefighter cancer," Freiberg said. "In the meantime, we want to make sure they're protected." Our life was so beautiful. Ashley and Scott Lethem met in middle school near Tacoma, Washington, and quickly became close friends. "Just friends," Ashley said. When her family moved to Arizona during high school, they stayed in touch, talking on the phone every weekend. She even flew back to Washington to attend a senior prom as his date. Something clicked in 2004 during one of his visits to Arizona, and the friendship turned romantic. They began an on-and-off long-distance relationship. 2 years later, Scott showed up at her doorstep. He had moved to Arizona for her, she said. He joined her family on vacations and won over her younger sisters, sitting on the floor to play games with them. They married in 2007 and had two children. "Our life was so beautiful," she said. Firefighting was her husband's calling, something he had wanted to do for as long as he could remember, but it also placed a strain on their family. The job market was highly competitive, with hundreds or even thousands of applicants for each opening. Scott put himself through paramedic school, and the family spent 8 years in Maricopa while he worked lower-paying public safety jobs. "Looking back," Lethem said, "the decision carried real risk. They were a young couple with young children trying to make ends meet." "They never imagined doing it any other way," she said with a grin. "There was no plan B." "He never took that job for granted," she said, "not a single day." It was in 2024 that everything changed. In May, he began experiencing headaches. By June, a scan revealed a bump on his nose, which they initially dismissed as a minor injury from his rough-and-tumble job. In July, after what would be his final shift, he collapsed onto his bed, exhausted. They went to the ER. Eventually, a CT scan revealed a tumor. Over the following weeks, after tests and doctor visits, the devastating truth became clear. He had only months to live. It was a sadness that Ashley, sitting in her living room a year later, struggled to describe. She said her husband had done everything right. No drinking, no smoking, no profanity. During the pandemic, he would remind his colleagues to keep their masks on. Meticulous and proud of his training, he worked to prevent accidents on the job. One colleague called him Captain America. We wanted to be so hopeful and positive, especially for our kids, she said, but it was terminal. Arizona firefighter cancer regulations face scrutiny. Public concern for firefighter safety has grown in recent years as the drying American West has fueled record-setting wildfires from Arizona to the Pacific Northwest. Firefighters face a significantly higher risk of dying from most cancers compared with the general population, according to a study commissioned by the American Cancer Society. For decades, the U.S. Forest Service prohibited federal firefighters from wearing N95 masks, deeming them too cumbersome for the job. In 2025, amid research and media reports linking the policy to the occupational cancer crisis, the agency reversed its position. Arizona has a cancer presumption law that allows firefighters and their families to automatically qualify for workers' benefits after certain cancer diagnoses. But the law is continually revisited as insurance companies and worker advocates debate what illnesses and treatment should be covered. "They're insurance companies," said Freiberg, the union president. "They look for loopholes. They look for technicalities." On the other side of it is our firefighters that got very sick in pursuit of serving their communities. Those fights are still ongoing. A single missing comma in Arizona's presumption law has allowed insurance companies to fight claims over adenocarcinoma and other types of cancers, an ABC 15 investigation found. In the coming legislative session, the union is promoting a bill that would change that. Every one of these issues is just another hurdle that the firefighters have to get through to get their stuff approved, Freiberg said. "I think my husband died for a reason." A year after her husband's death, Ashley Leatham is still in a daze. She said she's not the positive person she once was. "We love to laugh," she said. "That's probably the thing I miss the most." Posthumous tests suggested his cancer was linked to exposure to mold and cleaning chemicals. Ashley has since begun investigating the conditions at his fire station and meeting with leaders of the Tempe Fire Department, where several firefighters have died of cancer in recent years. "I think my husband died for a reason," she said. "If Scott's death can make changes for the better, I'll focus on that." "It is painful to think the job he loved so much killed him," she said. She knows he took pride in his work, running toward danger day after day to help others. In her living room, she proudly displays a metal plaque bearing his name and the department's seal, and a photo of him in full firefighting gear. Now, her son wants to be a firefighter just like his dad. "If I were to ask my husband, would the sacrifice be worth it?" said Leatham. "I think he would say yes." And that article was entitled "How Cancer is Upending Lives of Arizona Firefighters," and that was by Laura Gersoni. Our next article is entitled "Third Suspect in Murder Extradited from Georgia." This is by Perry Vandell. A third man accused of kidnapping and murdering a Tempe woman who was left inside a burning car in Tonopah while she was still alive in 2023, has been extradited to Arizona nearly 6 months after he was arrested in Georgia. Jared Gray, 26, was arrested in June 2024 after detectives with the Maricopa County Sheriff's Office discovered his fingerprint on the bottom of a plastic cup inside the white 2018 Chevrolet Malibu, where Mercedes Vega, 22, was found, according to court documents. Gray joined co-defendant Sincere Hayes, 23, and Cujo Young, 29, who faced numerous felony charges, including first-degree murder, kidnapping, and arson of an occupied structure. Gray is considered non-bondable and must eventually be returned to the Georgia Department of Corrections, according to arrest documents. Maricopa County Attorney Rachel Mitchell announced last month that her office would pursue the death penalty against Hayes and Young if they are convicted of murder. Mitchell hasn't said whether she would seek capital punishment for Gray as well. Erica Pillsbury, Vega's mother, has said she wants her daughter's killers put to death. I walk into the courtroom, Pillsbury previously told the Arizona Republic. I see them, their chests moving up and down, and I see them breathing, and I'm like, that is so unfair. That's my thought. My thought is, my daughter isn't breathing. Why are you breathing? Vega was killed in plot to silence testimony, investigators say. Vega was kidnapped in the parking garage of her Tempe apartment complex before being tortured, beaten, shot, and left to die in a Chevrolet Malibu set ablaze on April 17, 2023. Her death was the result of a brutal combination of blunt force trauma, gunshot wounds, severe burns, and smoke inhalation, meaning she was still alive as the Malibu burned, according to an autopsy report. Investigators say they ultimately connected the motive behind her murder to Young, whom Vega had previously identified as the suspect who robbed her at gunpoint after following her home from Les Girls Gentlemen's Club, where she worked as an exotic dancer in 2020. Detectives believe Young, who was once an NFL prospect, plotted to have Vega killed to prevent her from testifying in his armed robbery case, according to court documents. Detectives with the Maricopa County Sheriff's Office struggled to make an arrest in connection to Vega's killing until November 2024, when deputies arrested Hayes in Tennessee after discovering his fingerprint on a bloody grocery bag that had been left in Vega's car, according to court filings. The murder trial is currently scheduled for October 4, 2027, though such cases, especially capital cases, are often delayed for years due to their complexity. The trial for Young's armed robbery case is scheduled to begin on February 2nd. And that article is entitled Third Suspect in Murder Extradited from Georgia, and that was by Perry Vandell. This next article is entitled What to Know About AI Innovation Hub in Palo District. This is by Maritza Dominguez. An AI venture studio, WaveX, backed by LG Electronics, will land at Mesa's former Fiesta Mall, its owners announced. Nova Wave Capital, LG Electronics venture capital firm, made the announcement on January 7th at the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas. It was also announced that Sunny Day Sports would be an incoming investor. WaveX will be an innovation hub focused on AI technology startups centered on healthcare, energy, sports, and media. LG Nova also has innovation hubs in West Virginia and Silicon Valley. Tonton Ali Diallo, the founding managing partner, in a statement, said they are seeking to build the next generation of AI, energy and health companies that will accelerate America's innovation economy. The announcement was praised by Governor Katie Hobbs and Sandra Watson, president and CEO of the Arizona Commerce Authority. Hobbs called it a powerful addition to Arizona's thriving innovation ecosystem. WaveX will be folded into the previously announced Women's Sport Wellness Campus at Palo District, said Vicky Mayo, Sunny Day Sports CEO and manager of the Palo District LLC. The former Fiesta Mall site along Alma School Road and Southern Avenue is being reimagined after the city voted to designate the 80-acre site a theme park district, creating an avenue for an entertainment district. She said the hub will bring together the best and brightest technologies and incubate them to make them commercial ready to come out to the market. This would be an opportunity for us to really showcase Arizona as a strong state, Mayo said. The Innovation Hub will have synergy with the broader vision of the Palo District, she said. Mayo and her husband, Seymour Mayo, a board member of the Arizona Commerce Authority, have their own healthcare startup called Touchpoint Solution. That company aims to make a wearable technology widely available that helps manage stress by using BLAST, Bilateral Alternating Stimulation Tactile. She envisions similar startups coming out of WaveX. The Women's Sport Wellness Camp is expected to be delivered in 2028, Mayo said. And that article is entitled, What to Know About AI Innovation Hub in Palo District. And that was by Maritza Dominguez. We're going to move on now to national and world news with articles from USA Today. We've got two front page articles. The first is on Iran and the second is on trans sports. First article is entitled, Trump, Help is on its way. The subtitle is U.S. President Tells Iran to Keep Protesting. This is by Elweli Elweli and Bo Erickson. President Donald Trump on January 13th urged Iranians to keep protesting and remember the names of those abusing them, saying help is on the way, as Iran's clerical establishment pressed its crackdown against the biggest demonstrations in years. Iranian patriots, keep protesting, take over your institutions, help is on its way, Trump said in a post on Truth Social, without saying what that help might be. He said he had canceled all meetings with Iranian officials until the senseless killing of protesters stopped, and in a later speech told Iranians to save the name of the killers and the abusers because they'll pay a very big price. An Iranian official said about 2,000 people had been killed, the first time authorities have given an overall death toll from more than 2 weeks of nationwide unrest. U.S.-based rights groups Hirana said that of the 2,003 people whose deaths it had confirmed, 1,850 were protesters. It said 16,784 people had been detained, a sharp increase from the figure it gave on January 12th. Asked what he meant by help is on its way, Trump told reporters they would have to figure that out. On January 13th, Trump announced 25% import tariffs on products from any country doing business with Iran, a major oil exporter. Trump has also said more military action is among options he is weighing to punish Iran over the crackdown. The U.S. State Department urged American citizens to leave Iran now, including by land through Turkey or Armenia. Trump warns against executions. In an interview with CBS News on January 13th, Trump vowed a very strong action if Iran started hanging protesters, but again did not elaborate. I haven't heard about the hanging. If they hang them, you're going to see some things, Trump said. According to the Norway-based Iran Human Rights Society, hangings are common in Iranian prisons. HENGA, an Iranian Kurdish rights group, has reported that a 26-year-old man, Irfan Soltani, arrested in connection with protests in the city of Karaj, will be executed on January 14th. Authorities had told the family that the death sentence was final, HENGA reported, citing a source close to the family. Reuters could not independently confirm the report, and state media has not reported any death sentences so far. As he headed back to Washington from a visit to Detroit, Trump told reporters he would look at the whole situation that's going on in Iran, adding, "Really bad stuff." The message to the Iranian leadership is that they've got to show humanity. It would seem to me that they've been badly misbehaving, but that is not confirmed. Communications restrictions, including an internet blackout, have hampered the flow of information in Iran. The UN said phone service had been restored, but the internet still faced restrictions. Holistic Resilience, a U.S. organization that works to expand information access in repressive or closed societies, said on January 13th that billionaire Elon Musk's Starlink satellite internet service was now available for free in Iran. The unrest, sparked by dire economic conditions, has posed the biggest internal challenge to Iran's rulers for at least 3 years and has come at a time of intensifying international pressure after Israeli and U.S. strikes last year. Iranian authorities have accused the United States and Israel of fomenting the unrest. And Security Chief Ali Larijani said on X that Trump and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu were the main killers of the Iranian people. Tehran has not yet responded publicly to Trump's tariff announcement, but it was swiftly criticized by China, to which Iran exports much of its oil. Turkey, Iraq, the United Arab Emirates, and India among its other top trading partners. Iran's Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi said on January 12th he had continued to communicate with U.S. Special Envoy Steve Witkoff and that Tehran was studying ideas proposed by Washington. Russia on January 13th condemned subversive external interference in Iran's internal politics, saying any repeat of last year's U.S. strikes would have disastrous consequences for the Middle East and international security. The protests began on December 28th over the fall in value of the currency and have grown into wider demonstrations and calls for the fall of the clerical establishment. Iran's authorities have taken a dual approach, cracking down while also calling protests over economic problems legitimate, and as yet there are no signs of fracture in the security elite that could bring down the clerical system in power since a 1979 Islamic revolution. Britain, France, Germany, and Italy all summoned Iranian ambassadors in protest over the crackdown. The rising number of casualties in Iran is horrifying, European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen posted on X. Underscoring international uncertainty over what comes next in Iran, which has been one of the dominant powers across the Middle East for decades, German Chancellor Friedrich Merz said he believed the government would fall. I assume that we are now witnessing the final days and weeks of this regime, he said, adding that if it had to maintain power through violence, it is effectively at its end. And that article is entitled, Trump, Help is on Its Way. That was by Elweli Elweli and Bo Erickson. Our next front page article from USA Today is entitled, Trans Sports Bans Under Review. The subtitle is Supreme Court Reviews Laws Passed in West Virginia and Idaho. This is by Andrew Chung and John Kruzel. Conservative U.S. Supreme Court justices appeared ready on January 13th to uphold state laws banning transgender athletes from female sports teams amid escalating efforts nationwide to restrict the rights of transgender people. The justices heard more than 3 hours of arguments and appeals by Idaho and West Virginia of decisions by lower courts siding with transgender students who challenged the bans in the two states as violating the U.S. Constitution and a federal anti-discrimination law. 25 other states have similar laws on the books. Conservative justices raised concerns about imposing a uniform rule on the entire country amid sharp disagreement and uncertainty over whether medications like puberty blockers or gender-affirming hormones eliminate male physiological advantages in sports. Questions by the liberal justices mostly signaled sympathy for the transgender challengers. Sports are kind of a zero-sum game for a lot of teams, conservative Justice Brett Kavanaugh told Joshua Block, a lawyer for the transgender challengers. And someone who tries out and makes it, who is a transgender girl, will bump someone from the starting lineup, from playing time, from the team, from the all-league honors, and those things matter to people big time. Kavanaugh, who has coached girls' basketball teams, suggested that because the 1972 Title IX civil rights law that bars sex discrimination in schools and its related regulations permit teams separated by biological sex, it should be up to Congress to change that. The Idaho and West Virginia laws designate sports teams at public schools, including universities, according to biological sex, and bar students of the male sex from female athletic teams. The state said the laws preserve fair and safe competition for women and girls. If women don't have their own competitions, they won't be able to compete, Alan Hurst, Idaho's Solicitor General, arguing for the state, told the justices. Idaho's law classifies on the basis of sex, because sex is what matters in sports, Hurst said. It correlates strongly with countless athletic advantages like size, muscle mass, bone mass, and heart and lung capacity. The case could have wider repercussions for transgender people and affect whether other measures targeting them in the public sphere, including military service, bathroom access, treatment in classrooms, and designations in official documents such as passports, can be enforced. The challengers argued that the Idaho and West Virginia measures discriminate based on an individual's sex or status as a transgender person in violation of the Constitution's 14th Amendment guarantee of equal protection under the law, as well as Title IX, which bars discrimination in education on the basis of sex. Part of the arguments focused on how the Idaho law treats people differently, whether based on sex or their status as transgender, and whether that would require the court to more skeptically assess the reasons expressed by states for adopting such measures, a form of judicial review called intermediate scrutiny. There's no question here that a male who identifies as a female, but is a male, is being excluded from a female sport, Liberal Justice Sonia Sotomayor told Hearst. By its nature, that's a sex classification. And all sex classifications, we've said repeatedly in our case law, require intermediate scrutiny. The plaintiffs also contend that the use of certain medications by transgender students should matter regarding whether states can lawfully apply these bans to them if it could be shown that they do not possess sex-based advantages. Kathleen Hartnett, another lawyer for the challengers, said the Idaho plaintiff mitigated the physical advantage through the use of testosterone suppressants and estrogen, eliminating the ban's justification. Defenders of the ban say they are valid regardless of individual circumstances, and that physical advantages remain despite medical treatments. Denying a special accommodation to trans-identifying individuals does not discriminate on the basis of sex or gender identity or deny equal protection. All of that remains true, even assuming a man could take drugs that eliminate his sex-based physiological advantages, said Justice Department lawyer Hashim Mupan, arguing for the Trump administration. Conservative Justice Samuel Alito asked Hartnett to address some of the concerns expressed about transgender women athletes. There are an awful lot of female athletes who are strongly opposed to participation by trans athletes in competitions with them, Alito said. What do you say about them? Are they bigots? Are they deluded in thinking that they are subjected to unfair competition? Hartnett said she would not call them that. That's the reason why there is intermediate scrutiny, Hartnett said. You don't legislate based on undifferentiated fears. And that is all the time that we have for this article entitled Trans Sports Bans Under Review by Andrew Chung and John Kruzel. And this concludes the first hour of the Arizona Republic for Wednesday, January 14th, 2026. This has been Carrie, your volunteer reader with Sun Sounds of Arizona. Now, if you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org/broadcastinfo and audio/on-demand. You can take Sun Sounds with you. You can get our stream and on demand on our new Sun Sounds of Arizona app for Apple and Android phones. Now, please stay tuned for the second hour of the Arizona Republic.